From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're well into our fifth year of the Iraq War, but there's been a staggering decline in war coverage lately. It's all but disappeared from the newspaper front pages and the network nightly news. The Project for Excellence in Journalism tracked news coverage of the war. During the first 2.5 months of this year, coverage made up only 3% of airtime on network news. For that same time last year, the networks devoted nearly one-fourth of their time to Iraq. With the race for the White House underway and a sagging economy, Iraq has been pushed to the back burner. But at what cost? Here to help us sort it out are Andrew Tindall, author of the TindallReport.com, which tracks the coverage of the nightly network news, and Laura Flanders, host of Grit TV with Laura Flanders on Dish Network and GritTV.org, and author of Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. Hi, folks. How are you?
Hey.
Glad to be with you.
So, Andrew, you've actually crunched the latest numbers on the Iraq war coverage. How much airtime have the networks devoted to the conflict in the last 6 months of this year?
Yeah, the real good time frame to look at this is it was as if a light was switched off last September when David Petraeus came to Congress and testified that the surge was working and the military situation in Iraq was virtually under control. If you look at the entire coverage of the Iraq war on the network nightly newscast, up until that point, up until that week, you had each week, each and every week from 2003, you had 26, 27 minutes per week of coverage of the war. Since that time, it's down to six minutes of coverage per week. So we've gone down from 27 to 6, and it was like a light was switched off, and Petraeus said everything's under control, and journalists stopped covering the war.
Laura, the LA Times announced last week that the Tribune Company would be eliminating yet another 150 editorial positions in the newsroom, cutting down the weekly printed pages by 15%. So do you think that the decline in coverage is based largely on economics?
Well, you know, I'd like to believe so, and the LA Times foreign editor would certainly have us believe that economics is at the heart, and there's no question newspapers are in trouble. But when you look at the decline in coverage of Iraq, it's not just remote coverage, foreign coverage that's failing to get the airtime or the print space. It's also the domestic stories. I mean, if you look at the local papers around our country, you've got good reporting actually happening about combat-related stress disorder, suicides among vets. I'm looking at McClatchy's massive study on detainees in the so-called war on terror. Major reports, 8-part series, simply no pickup in the national press. You've got the Washington Times doing a report about the VA using Iraq vets as guinea pigs in drug tests, no pickup in the national press. And again, when you think about the economics, it's hard to credit this argument that it's money. When you've got, in the run-up to the Beijing Olympics, AP, for example, sending 319 people to Beijing. USA Today sending 19 reporters. The networks are all sending at least a dozen reporters. These are the same networks that between them have fewer than half a dozen in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. So, you know, I want to be sympathetic that money is the problem, but I don't buy it.
But isn't the magnitude of the financial issue so much higher? I mean, there are estimates that one bodyguard to protect one reporter costs $1,200 a day. These are contractors. That news organizations can spend, anywhere from $3 million to tens of millions of dollars a year. It's not just the cost of sending the reporters. It's also the cost of doing business in a war zone. And in fact, in some articles, journalists have said, well, I don't know, is it worth cutting back on other foreign coverage to cover the war?
Yeah, I still complain that that doesn't account for the failure to do good reporting about what happens to U.S. troops when they come home, doesn't explain the failure to do reporting on the situation of Iraqi refugees in Syria, for example, where the same kind of bodyguard costs aren't involved. If you've got European and French and German newswires doing reporting from inside Iraq, and even independent reporters in this country, Darja Mail and others, I just don't believe that the networks should be, or need to be making these kind of calculations. You know, it goes back to what's happened to our news industry, where if our news division doesn't make a profit, it's considered a failure. Yet there is a responsibility on the part of our media to cover these critical stories. There are choices being made to send 319 people to Beijing and keep barely half a dozen in Iraq. And then there are a whole lot of other choices being made, too. It's not just about money.
Andrew, let me get...
Up until last September, which was the breaking point that I talked about, there was enormous coverage. They were swallowing those costs for years. In fact, 2004, 2005, 2006, you could argue that it actually was more dangerous in Baghdad then than it is now. So the cost of security and stuff, that was greater then than it is now. But it's only now that the cutback in coverage has happened. So they were spending an awful lot of money on an unpopular story for year after year after year, and then just suddenly stop doing it.
And I will remind once again, there is a difference between what the big dominant media are doing and the amount of news time that is going to Iraq in the networks. And Andrew's reporting, you know, 2 minutes per network per week is what we're getting today. Less than 3% of the news hold when it was 23% last fall. At that level, we're seeing the change. At the level of local newspapers covering what's happening to their local troops coming home, there's a very different picture. So we have another set of choices being made about what stories are we in the power media going to pick up and run with, in addition to all this stuff about where are we going to deploy our people.
Let me jump in and ask Andrew, where is the news coverage going? I mean, since what you do is really look at the networks and parse out, you know, what individual topics they cover, often you look at the guests, what are you seeing? What is eating up the news hole?
Yes, well, what you said in your introduction is absolutely right. So you hit the nail on the head there, but the extent to which you're right, I think you really underestimated it. First of all, my database happens to go back for comparing this election cycle to the previous five election cycles, and the campaign coverage for the first half of 2008, January through June, exceeded each other cycle by an order of magnitude. Let's put it this way. The campaign coverage for this race, 2008, is greater than the campaign coverage for 2000 and 2004 combined. That's how newsworthy this election cycle has been. So there's a lot of where you can say that actually the campaign coverage has just taken the oxygen out of all other coverage on the national level, not just Iraq, but all other stories. There is one other story that has survived and actually thrived in the current news environment, and that is the story on the economy. You know, you add together gasoline prices, food prices, housing prices, stock prices, unemployment, all of those stories all added together. And we are on the pace in this year, in 2008, to have the highest level of economy coverage on the network newscast in the last two decades. The previous high was in the recession of 1990, and this economy is more newsworthy than the economy was in the recession of 1990.
Do you think that's a bad thing, though? I mean, the economy, if you had to say what was on people's minds, I would guesstimate that the economy is first, you know, whether your wallet is in trouble, and then the presidential election in Iraq far after. Isn't it just a matter of giving people what?
Absolutely. You know, we can talk about, we can deplore or be critical of the networks for pulling back their resources in the coverage of Iraq. And that's one statement, which, I mean, it's a true statement, and I think they've overdone their pullback. But you can't criticize them for saying, and as a consequence of pulling back, they've resorted to fluff.
But you can say that there's a connection between the two. As that excellent public editor of the Sacramento Bee reported in the end of March, you know, this country is spending, we taxpayers are spending $12.5 billion a month, or nearly $5,000 a second on this deployment in Iraq. That isn't unrelated to the economic picture. So again, if media wanted to integrate these stories, give people the big picture from which they can make sense of their world, they could. They're not doing it.
And also, it is true to say that one of the major issues in the presidential campaign is what should our policy be in Iraq. So, you know, the Iraq story is being covered indirectly through the prism of campaign coverage.
And there's hardly a campaign event where some protester doesn't show up. So, again, if you wanted to put that into the story, you could.
Let me pull out a little bit from what we've been talking about and ask each of you to give me a little bit of perspective. Where do you think that the news media that all of us are a part of in some way will be equipped to continue coverage of this war as it extends indefinitely, but certainly for the coming year, couple years? Laura?
I think we're equipped. We've got people on the ground we can talk to via Skype. We've got people we can read the blogs of and distribute what they're saying. We've got reporters, like the photographer who was recently kicked out of Iraq for showing the photograph of a dead Marine, whose photograph we could put front and center. I think we have the means, and we're increasingly developing contacts in the region that we can use. May we need, you know, will we need to stretch to take our Iraq coverage from someone who isn't necessarily a celebrity reporter in this country? I think probably, because I don't think we see a network commitment to sending, you know, to developing bureaus of their top U.S. correspondents.
But I have to go
we
to
have
Andrew.
A global media that we can use here, and we will.
Andrew.
Yes. I think, you know, we talk about Iraq, but actually what's newsworthy about Iraq is the Iraq war. And there's a whole lot of policies with regard to Iraq that are going to be much harder for the news media, especially the video television news media, to cover. And that is the things like the, you know, do we have permanent bases there? What should the oil leases be given to multinational firms, or should the oil industry stay nationalized in Iraq? You know, the internal politics of Iraq, stuff like that, where there isn't any blood on the screen. It's much harder for video news to cover, and I think in the current state of at least television journalism, those sort of stories are just going to fall by the wayside.
Okay, well, Andrew, Laura, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks, Farai.
Thank you.
Joining us were Andrew Tindall with thetindallreport.com and Laura Flanders, host of Grit TV with Laura Flanders on Dish Network and grittv.org, and author of Blue Grit, True Democrats Take Back Politics from the Politicians. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It's time now for our Africa update. Leaders from the world's wealthiest nations started meeting yesterday in Japan. The leaders of what's called the G8 met with seven African leaders to talk about issues including the global food crisis and politics in Zimbabwe. And the fertility business looks for a new market among African women. For all this and more, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of TransAfrica Forum. Hi, Bill.
Hey, how are you?
I am great. So, First of all, we keep using the phrase G8. What is the G8?
The Group of Eight, which was for many years the Group of Seven, are the eight largest economies on the planet. So the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Japan, and Russia are, for example, G8 countries.
So when people from these nations meet and talk about an African agenda, what do they bring to the table and what's on the table this time around?
Well, I'll try not to give you a cynical answer, but basically the Group of Eight meet to discuss the world's economy. For the most part, that's what they're supposed to be talking about. But over the last number of years, there's been greater attention to the question of Africa and issues of economic development. And there's been a lot of pressure on the Group of Eight to come forward with financial assistance, changes in the relationship, economic relationships, in order to promote development. And so once again, that came to the table this time, in addition to sort of a review of what the G8 has accomplished and not accomplished towards reducing poverty.
Now, when we look at this, what they're doing, there was a, you know, in some ways perhaps a minor incident, but a telling one where the British publication The Telegraph reported online that the G8 leaders enjoyed a 6-course lunch followed by an 8-course dinner. African leaders were not invited, and of course they're talking about the global hunger situation. There was a lot of static about that. Do you think that that was symbolic in any way or just, you know, big time world business as usual?
Well, Farai, now you're going to draw the cynical side out on me. This was an incredibly stupid, careless move by the G8 leaders, where they basically seemed to have thought off camera they could do whatever they wanted to. And they demonstrated for all to see the contempt actually that they have towards towards the rest of the world. That they basically, they see themselves as in effect the rulers of this planet. So when they're on camera, there'll be the tears, there'll be the concern. Off camera, you saw this hideous example of consumption.
What do you think the G8 leaders should be doing in terms of an Africa agenda? I'm going to get to a couple of specific things, specific national issues of Zimbabwe and Nigeria in a second.
Sure.
But when you talk about members of what we call the developed world dealing with the entire continent of Africa, is there any one agenda that you can even talk about?
Well, there should be. There should be. I mean, there are certain things that the G8 could do almost in their sleep. They've committed to billions of dollars to Africa, and the track record so far is very uneven. President Bush, for example, says that the United States is on the road to fulfilling its obligations. What that means is hard for me to determine at this point. But there are things that could be done. For example, there had been steps that have been taken in the past towards debt cancellation. Not debt forgiveness, but debt cancellation. There needs to be a full implementation of that. Another thing that is desperately needed is the sort of economic assistance that repairs the damages that were brought about by colonialism and the Cold War. And the problem, Farai, is that all too often when we're approaching economic issues with Africa, the West attempts to reconfigure African economies essentially to serve the interests of the West, as opposed to serving the interests of the people of Africa. Economic assistance needs to be directed towards building infrastructure and building the kinds of economies that help the people of Africa. That could be the core of an agenda.
What about Zimbabwe? What is on the table in these meetings, if anything, about Zimbabwe?
Well, they just came out with a statement about Zimbabwe. It appears that President Bush and Prime Minister Brown were trying to push for endorsement of sanctions. The statement, which I looked at very briefly, is a statement that's critical of the situation, that basically says that no government can be recognized if it doesn't fully represent the people of Zimbabwe, and that the G8 will keep on top of this. That's not bad. And I say not bad because neither the United States nor Britain actually have the moral authority to push through sanctions, particularly in light of Iraq. But to say that they will stay on top of the situation and particularly to back up the African Union and the Southern African Development Community, I think it's a good move. And I think that is what's important. Now the next step is really, what is the African Union willing to do, and specifically, what is South Africa willing to do?
Let's move to Nigeria, because Nigeria called on the G8 leaders to help stop oil theft. They are preparing a proposal to outline the steps to stop the illegal trade, which could be helping to cause conflicts within the country. Tell us a little bit more about how that unfolds, how the oil wealth is being siphoned off.
Well, it's actually a very serious problem in Nigeria that goes back years. I mean, Nigeria is a major oil producer, and what's happened as a result, and this you can see this in many oil-producing countries, is that you have a vast disparity of wealth and investment. So you have, a very developed oil industry that contrasts with low development in other parts of the economy. You have immense amount of wealth that's been captured by individuals at the same time that you have incredible poverty. And on top of all of that, you have an extensive amount of environmental devastation in oil areas along the coast. So what's happening is that over the years, there's been tapping into, literally into the lines of the fuel so that people can either get the oil to sell or, in many cases, get it to survive. That is, to get basic fuel so that they can cook their foods. So the situation is very grave. And what's happened over the last several years is that there's been, in effect, an uprising along the coast in Nigeria, where the people there have felt that they have not been the recipients of any portion of the wealth that's been accumulated by Nigeria's investment in oil.
I want to move to a final topic that is a little unusual. I mean, a lot of times when we talk on our show about Africa, we have a lot of kind of tough news to report, but it's not a monolithic continent in any way, and there's certainly plenty of people with wealth. And now there is a look at whether or not in vitro fertilization, which has become very popular in the U.S., should move over to Africa. And there's a group of doctors in Europe that want to introduce lower cost in vitro in Africa. Do you think that's a sign of either some of the wealth or some of the changes in lifestyle that are going on the continent?
I think it's probably reflective of several different things. One is the rising power of women in Africa, who are demanding changes in health care and also demanding changes that are to their benefit. And I think that that's very important. I think you can look at many countries in Africa and see the emergence of women's movements that are very, very significant. And I'm talking about all different parts of the continent, South Africa, Nigeria, certainly on the east coast of Africa. So I think that that's one thing. The issue that I would pose is to the need to link this with the comprehensive issue of healthcare on a continent. When you're talking about anything related to childbirth and sex, you have to talk about sex, which means that you also have to talk about STDs, HIV and AIDS. There needs to be a real comprehensive look at sexual health, and as well as the sexual rights of women.
All right, so, we have to end it here, but thanks
okay.
So much, Bill.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of TransAfrica Forum, and he spoke with us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. More Americans are turning to alternative medicine than ever before. We're talking about acupuncture, homeopathy, or herbs. China has a long history of generating this medical wisdom. But what about African nations? Do their traditions have something to offer in the modern-day search for health? Dr. Kamal Kokai has traveled the world to find out the answer. He runs a holistic medical center in New York, which combines Western medicine with medical practices from other countries, including many from Africa. Dr. Kokai, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Tell us, why do you think people are seeking alternatives to Western medicine?
I think there's a recognition that there's a, and I'm going to use the word, a profound limitation on what can be achieved by just going through your routine medical visits and treatment. And within that, if you're not feeling well, people are looking for answers to see how they can feel better, how they can improve their health. So more and more people have turned, looked in different directions to see what is available to them.
Give us a little bit of your history, because you've had an interesting walk of going to Yale Medical School and then also traveling the world. What was the spark that set you in both those directions?
Well, prior to me going to medical school, I was actually a vegetarian. I was a martial artist. And I got exposed to concepts of diet and nutrition as it impacted health. And I got exposed to concepts of energy with respect to martial arts practice. And I really didn't see any of that in my medical school experience. Along with that, I had a just really open-ended approach to looking at medicine. Being an African American, I was not one of the good old boys in medical school. So you can either try hard to be a part of that club, or you can say to yourself, well, gosh, maybe there are some other things that can actually be explored. So Chinese medicine, I explored that. I explored classical homeopathy. I explored nutrition. I explored other, particularly African cultural arts. And out of that, it just opened a whole worldview to me.
Give us some specifics on what African traditional medicine you might incorporate into your practice.
at the heart of traditional African medicine is God and the ancestors. Okay, so now you have many Africans that want to take advantage of traditional medicine, but they don't want to acknowledge the roots. So the roots, as I'm saying, is understanding a relationship with ancestors in terms of ancestors being a part of a community. The use of divination. On the surface, I mean, we've seen different things maybe on TV where someone is throwing bones or cowrie shells and then makes a pronouncement. But divination is creating a space where you have objects that have a metaphorical representation with respect to elements of a person's life. Divination is something that takes training. And as with all cultures, of course, there's herbal medicine and understanding of diet. But the fundamental premise with African culture is linking everything back with God and the ancestors being at the central core.
We did an interview with someone who is a spiritual leader in one of the many traditional African spiritual practices. And what you're talking about sounds, in many ways, more like spirituality than medicine. Do you see yourself practicing both, or how?
I'm a regular doc, so I practice a number of disciplines. But by bringing spirituality into what you're doing, that helps you in terms of being more effective with people. The difficulty with this in this country, I guess, with respect to African Americans incorporating more of traditional African medicine. Because traditional African medicine doesn't, in many respects, make that distinction between God and the medicine and the work with plants and herbs, right? African Americans here have been trained to think that the God they worship is different than the God that's worshipped by indigenous Africans. So as a result, and they've been trained to, look down on things that are African. So we'll use words like voodoo or witch doctor. So part of it is just the mindset. But spirituality, how can you be a healer without embracing some aspects of the spirit? You can't. So there's a real distinction between practicing medicine, the dispensation of drugs, making a diagnosis, and actually working to heal people.
Finally, when you look at the kind of work that you do, but also more broadly at how medicine is practiced, what do you see as the future for the way that people can combine Western medicine and other forms of medical practice?
Well, I think we're at an interesting crossroads because modern medicine has had to acknowledge that there are other forms of medicine because of the way people are spending their dollar. People spend more money seeing alternative practitioners than they do in seeing their primary care doctors. They make more visits to alternative care. The problem is now that modern medicine is seeking to determine what's efficacious. It's seeking to try to squeeze everything into a biomedical model in terms of testing and creating whatever evidence that they need to create to write an article. But you can't really do this with energy medicine. So I think that what's going to happen is you're having stronger associations of people that are naturopaths, chiropractors, people doing cranial sacral work. So what's happening is that people are getting skills in areas that are allowing them to encroach on things that have previously been treated just by modern medicine. Clinics and hospitals are going to have to move more in the direction of an integrative medical facility.
Well, Dr. Kakai, great to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate the time and just to share and put those ideas out there.
Dr. Kamau Kokai is the medical director of Kokai Health Center for Holistic Medicine. He also hosts the New York radio show Global Medicine Review. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Hill Harper has built a huge fan base in his role as Dr. Sheldon Hawks in the CBS show CSI New York, but he's also made time to write books and mentor young adults. His 2006 book, Letters to a Young Brother, is a collection of letters by prominent African Americans to young black men. Harper now has a similar book aimed at young black women. It's called Letters to a Young Sister, Define Your Destiny. Actress Gabrielle Union wrote the foreword to Harper's latest book, and both of them filled us in on what they're doing to make sure it reaches its audiences. Hi, folks.
Hi.
So, you know, this book is one hill where you really start out by talking about a woman who really didn't even speak her mind, but who came to one of your book readings. Tell me that story.
When I wrote my first book, Letters to a Young Brother, Manifest Your Destiny, it felt very organic because I was writing to young men. I had been gifted books when I was young that really served as mentorship on paper for me. They helped me navigate the journey from boyhood to manhood. My goal was to write a book that could equally inspire today's young men, and that's what I was thinking about. But when I was on my book tour and young women would come to the book signings and say, well, what about us? You talk about how these young men are the newest perfect model and how you're trying to build up their self-esteem. How come I never hear that from young men? How come I never hear that from men about me? And then you start to dig underneath the surface and you start to realize that two-thirds of our young women are being raised by single mothers who are doing the best they can. But oftentimes, the love and affection that they get from males, and particularly in terms of platonic love and affection, is missing. And then it's no wonder why a lot of our young women go in search of male affection and love, and sometimes with the wrong people in the wrong way in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Gabrielle, let's talk a little bit about your role. You wrote the foreword to the book, and you have done so many things. You've been in action movies like Bad Boys 2. You've been Alice Cramden in The Honeymooners. You've been on Ugly Betty. And I'm sure people in our culture think of you as kind of untouchably beautiful and elegant, which is fabulous. But, you know, you have a lot more complicated of a story. What kind of a teenager were you in terms of relating to your parents about what you should be in life?
I was according to them, if you ask them, they'd say I was a perfect child. I was a model child because I did everything that was asked of me. I got great grades. I was a great athlete. I was a student leader. But what was going on inside and what I was dealing with individually and as a group of girls, as a part of a large group of girls, it was absolute turmoil. Emotionally, physically, spiritually, we were sort of forced to deal with very adult issues and situations as a collective. And or oftentimes we didn't even turn to each other. We would internalize everything. And so I was going through major low self-esteem. I was the black girl in an all-white school in an all-white community, never feeling good enough, but always being encouraged by my parents to be bigger, badder, better, and perfect is the standard. You starting to like guys, and you know, in my own town, you know, with me being the black girl, the white guys weren't really checking for me that way. My hair isn't straight enough. My nose isn't pointy enough. My lips are too big. My boobs aren't big enough. Like, and you start going through all of that. I've realized as I've gotten older, a lot of the same issues I was dealing with at 15, I'm dealing with at 35.
So when you think about the fact that you, like so many of us, are still walking a path towards self-acceptance, what kind of hope can you actually give to teen girls? You know, can you say it's going to get easier?
You know, my niece is 15, and she's dealing with her skin. She's dealing with her hair. She's dealing with a growing acceptance of her nose. It's such a similar struggle, but at the same time, I can say I have gotten a little bit further along on that journey, and there is definitely light at the end of the tunnel. But we don't generally share these stories.
Hill, I want to talk a little bit more about your philosophical approach to this. You quote a ton of people, from religious leaders to authors to people in your family. What do you consider wisdom?
Wow. Well, wisdom, first and foremost, to me, has a lot to do with self-compassion. You can't start or even think about future-based ideas that are wisdom-oriented if you don't feel that you're worthy of a future. So I think that the key is to deal with self-esteem and self-worth first. Apply some self-compassion to that so that you start to love and accept aspects of yourself. And then we can start talking about wisdom. So wisdom is anything that hits home with you and seeps through the noise that may be blocking you, whether it's fear, like I call fear false evidence appearing real. That's what fear stands for, because most of the fears we have and most of the insecurities all of us have, they're false. They've been told to us by some type of untrue cultural reality that has nothing to do with the actual fact that most of us as human beings want something extremely fundamental, and that's to be loved, and to love others. And that's it. It gets really simple if we can get through all the noise.
Let's talk a little bit about recovery from trauma. Gabrielle, you had to deal with sexual assault, and you've talked about this before, and in this book, you really do talk movingly about kind of how you had to accept something that was not your fault and then move forward. Tell us just a little bit about what you went through, but then how you move forward.
You know, growing up, like I said, my parents created this very idyllic childhood. Nothing bad is supposed to happen. We are the Joneses. We've caught up with the Joneses. We've got this great house. We live in this great neighborhood. You know, everyone is educated. Nothing bad is supposed to happen. And I go to work, and I am raped and beaten at work at my summer job. And this part of the shock of it all, aside from just the sexual assault, is that our perfect world, as I knew it, was shattered. Everything I put my trust and faith in was taken away, on top of my body being, you know, ravaged. And what came out of that was bad things happen to people every day. You're not the only one, you know, carrying this cross. There's a lot of people who deal with adversity on a daily basis, and much worse. What are you going to do about it? You can be a victim for the rest of your life because people will let you. They'll be like, well, you know, she was raped. That's why she didn't, you know, ever finish school. That's why she never became anything. She was raped. And they will allow this sisterhood of victim, you know, of victimhood to go on and on and on and on. And as a perfect excuse for why you never became anything. Or you can say, bad things happen to people every day. How am I going to choose to deal with this? And I chose to stay in school. I chose to make sure I wasn't, you know, I turned in my paper on Monday. And I remember during the rape kit thinking, oh, God, I got to recheck my bibliography because I have to turn this paper in on Monday. Like, failure is not an option. Doesn't matter what is going on. And I made that choice for myself. And when I made that choice, everyone around me was like, okay, we don't have a victim here. We immediately have a survivor, and we're going to put everything, every option in her path to create the best, happiest, healthiest survivor that we can have.
Hill, what about that same question of being resilient? I mean, bouncing back from any number of setbacks, whether they're ones that they inspired themselves, like maybe not studying in school and dropping out, or ones that that no one could have predicted and come out of the blue.
Well, the message that I try to reinforce is that this is a journey, and there are always going to be obstacles of different sizes, shapes, and they come at you from different ways. But there's always going to be something beautiful as well. And it's how you ultimately create and walk this path that's going to determine if you're going to be able to achieve the things that you know deep inside you can achieve. But part of the problem is a lot of the young women I talk to don't even allow themselves to dream because they've been disappointed so many times. And so it's almost like a restart of saying, first, you have permission to dream. So dream big. And then I say, okay, whatever you said you dreamed big on, I want you to double it. And then after you doubled it, you still haven't dreamed big enough. And then they start to get the message that they have been given permission to dream so big that anything is possible. And that's what it's about. It's about looking forward and ultimately not looking back. And I'm not talking about denying the past and trying to erase things, but it's also, again, looking at yourself from a place of self-compassion, self-forgiveness, and moving forward to something amazing.
On that note, Hill, Gabrielle, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Actor Hill Harper is author of the new book, Letters to a Young Sister, Define Your Destiny. He spoke with us from WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. He was joined by Gabrielle Union. She's in the new Eddie Murphy movie, Meet Dave, opening this Friday. And Gabrielle joined us from our NPR studios in Culver City, California. Want more? You can catch this entire interview with Hill Harper and Gabrielle Union on our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. Dr. Bobby Jones is the face of gospel. That is, he hosts the popular BET show Bobby Jones Gospel, a major television venue for gospel stars. Dr. Jones decided to put together an 8-CD set called The Ultimate Gospel Collection. It compiles music by artists from Mahalia Jackson to Aretha Franklin. Our very own Tony Cox sat down with Dr. Jones to talk about the past and future of gospel.
Dr. Bobby Jones, welcome to News and Notes. It's a pleasure to have you on with us.
And it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
This gospel collection, the Bobby Jones Presents Ultimate Gospel, is quite an undertaking. 7-box CD set. That's what, 140, 150 gospel songs?
Enough to save you and send you to heaven straight up.
How did this idea...
By the time you get through with this collection, let me tell you, you'll be singing hallelujah all the time.
You will be ready to go and meet the maker, won't you?
Yes.
How did this idea come about, and how difficult was it to select the songs that were included in the collection?
Well, actually, my part in this presentation had more to do with the development of the sales procedures rather than a total number of selections of the music. They did confer with me about some of the artists that they thought that should be in the collection, especially. It took us quite a while to put the production element together. By the way, this is the first time that they had ever done a live infomercial like that in a church with an audience and a choir and two very special guests.
I'm singing Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Martha, don't have to mourn.
Oh, Martha, don't you mourn.
Listen to me, Mary.
Oh, Mary, don't you weep.
Martha, don't have to mourn.
Oh, Martha, don't you mourn.
The collection is broken into 7 CDs, as we said, and each volume has a sort of theme, like Peace in the Valley, which features some of gospel's greatest artists from the Golden Age, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, Mahalia Jackson, the great quartets like the Swan Silvertones, Pilgrim Travelers, and of course the very special groups like the Caravans. There is a great deal of musical history on just this one CD alone, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it is. A tremendous amount of wonderful things that you can think about when you think of gospel music. I was very pleased because it represents the traditional element of our industry. And right now, we're basically into the kind of hip-hop, contemporary, urban gospel swinging kind of situations when it comes to praise right now. But we can never progress further than where we came from. So I was delighted to see Sister Rosetta Tharpe, of course. And, you know, there's a difference between quartet and gospel singing, and we sometimes have to define those differences. But to have the quartet and gospel together, and I'm sure with all the other elements that we have, it makes for a very interesting presentation, and especially for those people who study music and use gospel as one of their entities that they want to include in their curriculum. They can break it down into the various sections, the various periods, I should say.
For those of you that think that gospel music has gone too far, you think we've gotten too radical with our message, well, I got news for you. You ain't heard nothing yet. And if you don't know, now you know. Glory, glory!
Gospel music, of course, isn't just one sound. We know that. There's traditional, as we've said, and there's contemporary, as we've also said. And you've got both of them represented here. Who are some of the more contemporary artists that were selected, and why were they selected, if you know?
Well, they were selected because of their visibility and their airplay and their appeal to the general audiences. People like a Tremaine Hawkins and a Smokey Norful and, you know, a Kirk Franklin and a Yolanda Adams, these people that come along in the modern day kind of presentations of gospel music represent that. And, you know, Edwin Hawkins was the... we call him the father of contemporary gospel music. So his inclusiveness was quite obvious, along with Tremaine, who is the one who led the Oh Happy Day on that first CD. So that was the beginning of the contemporary sound.
Oh, happy day.
Happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus
wore. Oh, when he wore.
When Jesus wore
washed my sins away,
oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Oh, happy day.
Now, we just, coincidentally, we had one of the artists who's featured in the collection, Al Green, in studio here at NPR.
Oh, really?
Yes, we did. And he talked about singing secular and non-secular music and trying to bridge both worlds. A number of the artists in this collection fit into that category as well. I'm thinking about, for example, the Winans or Ann Nesby or even the Commodores. How much of a challenge is it for gospel artists to sing God's praises on one hand and to try to have successful careers to a larger non-gospel audience at the same time?
Well, the Winans wouldn't really fit into that category, but the other artists that you mentioned certainly would. It depends upon, I think, what kind of position that those artists take in reference to whether it's going to be something that will irritate people from a spiritual perspective, or whether their music just talks about life in general or just love in general as male, female. And I think people like Al Green is basically kind of, and Aretha Franklin, easy to use their material because they don't go as deep as it could be. That would be a little bit insulting or irritating to the Christian ear.
Which one of these seven CDs do you like the best?
Now, look, I don't, I do not separate myself when it comes to God's music. We do sometimes have our preferences, but I'm leaning more toward the traditional sound with a little flair of the contemporary element. People like the old Happy Day thing. You know, it moves, but yet it's, you know, it has the traditional feel. So I'm going to lean in that direction if I have to do that. But everything that but if everything that lifts up the name of Jesus for me and give me some rhythm with it sometimes, and then some soberness at other times, that impresses me. The lyrical content is just, that's the saving grace to all of the music.
Dr. Bobby Jones, thank you so much for taking some time and spending it with us at News and Notes.
And I do appreciate the time as well from you, and thank you.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with Dr. Bobby Jones. He put together the multi-player CD Ultimate Gospel Collection with Time Life. He also hosts the BET show Bobby Jones Gospel. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing our time with us. We go to the website at nprnewsandnotes.org and to the blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium.